Cheers.
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 Cheers. Cheers. Cheers.
Oh, right. Skull.
With all the enthusiasm.
This process of like taking something apart and putting it back together again in the wrong order, which I think is sort of at the heart of taxidermy and is also how Ira made the poem, like they rearranged the words of this taxidermy manual. That was sort of my process in making this piece, and it's something that sort of unfolds over the scope of the whole piece.
Cheers!
Cheers! Cheers.
Welcome to Pour Me a Mozart. I'm Asia, and I'm here with Patty. And today our guest is Paul Novak. So welcome, Paul. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's so great to be here drinking a Boulevardier at 1 p.m. on Easter Sunday.
No one would know that.
Yeah, so my name is Paul Novak. I'm a composer and a flutist, currently based in Chicago, although I was based in Houston before that, and I'm originally from Nevada. I write all different kinds of music, a lot of chamber music and vocal music and orchestra and different kinds of interdisciplinary things. I also write a lot. This is something Patty knows, is that I write a lot of poetry too, and that's a big part of who I am and a big part of my practice too. But yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear more about all of your writing. So before we get into that, let's talk about the drink that we're having. So this is a Boulevardier, which is, according to liquor.com, 1 1/4 ounces bourbon, 1 ounce Campari, and then 1 ounce sweet vermouth. So I actually haven't taken a sip of mine yet, so I'm going to go ahead.
Why does mine look way oranger than anyone? Okay.
Wait, these are such different colors. It's true.
Yeah. It's okay.
Well, my glass is not really clear. It has like a grayish tinge.
Okay. That makes me feel better. Okay.
Yeah. It is so true. Yours is like bright red.
Patty. Yeah. Okay. Well, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers. So I love the concept of this drink. As Patty knows, I love a Negroni, and this is basically a whiskey version of a Negroni. There's lots of variation to be had within this drink, so I'll just get started and say I used bullet bourbon. You can also use a rye whiskey, and I used sweet vermouth. Yeah, do you remember what you used, Paul?
So I used the only kind of bourbon I had in my cabinet, which unfortunately was Jack Daniel's. But I feel like this is also a drink where the Campari flavor is the main thing you're getting. And so I think that, for me, the Campari is sort of the star of the show, and it's still delicious, which is great. Uh-huh. And I think I always like to do equal parts, just like when I do a Negroni. So equal parts of, in that case, gin, Campari, and vermouth. And here I did bourbon too. I think for that way, it makes it taste slightly less alcohol-y, maybe. Mm. I don't know. I'm not a great mixologist, but I do like cocktails.
How did you stumble on this cocktail?
So I've been drinking Negronis for a couple years now. I think I had it for the first time actually when I was in Italy, and I was like drinking the Negroni Spalliato before it went viral, and I feel very, very special for that.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, I like always have Campari in my cabinet, and I'm always sort of experimenting with other cocktails with Campari. And so that was sort of how I discovered it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, you truly went to the source then.
I did.
In Italy.
Yeah.
Do you have a sweet vermouth preference?
I think I've only ever had one brand.
Is that the like red, like swirly things? That's Dole.
Yeah. Yes, it is that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I sometimes will make it with dry vermouth if that's only what I have in my cabinet too, which is a very different kind of taste. It's sort of more martini kind of flavor. Yeah.
Well, definitely more bitter.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Patty, what are you using?
Okay. So I had to scoot and run and grab my ingredients because I was like, oh God, what did I use? Yesterday I was around Trader Joe's and I was looking at their selection, and they actually, I didn't realize this, they have their own Kentucky bourbon, and it's reasonably priced, and I haven't tried it yet in like on its own, so to be determined if how I feel about the bourbon itself. But I thought, you know, it's probably going to be good in a mixed drink no matter what, right? So here it is. This is a Trader Joe's brand of bourbon whiskey. Apparently, they say it's from the Bourbon Square Distilling Company, if anyone knows that, in Louisville. And then everyone, you know, Campari is just like, Campari, you can't change that. And then I also got my sweet vermouth from Trader Joe's as well, which I don't know. I've never seen this before.
I've never seen that either.
Okay. It's Rosso Vermouth Aperitivo Sol from Italy.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's a Trader Joe's exclusive or what, but this is the sweet vermouth. So I feel like they'd be kind of fun to do some kind of like side-by-side taste testing of sweet vermouth, because I feel like it really, or dry vermouth, because I feel like that really does affect the drink.
It does.
Yeah, totally, totally. I do love how today you're just sponsored by Trader Joe's, Patty.
I know, right?
We should send them an email and ask for a sponsorship.
Yeah.
I did get my Campari at Trader Joe's as well. So yeah, nice. I know. Sorry, I don't know.
So there's a little bit more room for variation. I had some Aperol left over from another episode where we had Aperol Spritz, and I thought maybe I would just sub in Aperol for Campari, but I decided to go the traditional route and I got a bottle of Campari. I've actually been making my Negronis with Aperol also. It's just a little bit sweeter, so the bitter edge is taken off a little bit.
That sounds delicious. Yeah, I feel like for some people, Campari is like a little bit too cough syrupy too. Yeah. I can totally, totally see that. And Aperol is so delicious too.
Yeah. All right, so let's see what liquor.com has to say about the Boulevardier.
Well, while you're doing that, can I just like throw in some sort of like pour me a Mozart trivia sort of thing?
Yes.
Which is that I feel like the Boulevardier, is that how you pronounce it?
That's how I said it.
Okay. Because Paul made it sound like way more fancy. And I was like, oh my God, I don't think I'm pronouncing it right.
My French is not great. So, I mean, Paul probably said it the right way.
Me neither. Yeah, okay, I'm in the same boat. Yeah.
Well, anyway, since this is a spinoff of a Negroni just with bourbon, I was just going to say that my very first episode recording with Asia on Pour Me a Mozart, I sort of introduced her to the Negroni. And
you
then
reintroduced me.
I reintroduced you, excuse me. Okay, so it's sort of this, and ever since then, I feel like you've really gone down the hill with that. Like I feel like more times I'm like, oh, what are you enjoying right now? And you're like, oh, Negroni. I'm like, okay, that's great. Like.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that reintroduction. I tried it once, like right when I started bartending, and I was like, "Oh, this tastes like acid. I cannot drink this." Mm-hmm. The restaurant also celebrated Negroni Day, which I could not tell you when that is anymore. But we had the restaurant was called Public, and we had a Public Negroni, which was just subbing in Aperol for the Campari. And I thought that was slightly better. But I still didn't like it very much. So thank you, Patty, for introducing me to my new favorite drink.
I
think of you every time I make a Negroni. So.
Yeah, well, then I'm always happy to hear it. I just feel like maybe Campari as an ingredient is just one of those acquired tastes for people. So keep trying if you don't like it at first. You want, 100%, no pressure either. Okay.
You like what you like.
So yeah, there's this restaurant in Chicago that has frozen Negronis called Parsons, and it is like one of my favorite things. Like this,
is it like a snow cone or something like that? Or
it's like, you know, like they have frozen margs sometimes. It's just like that. Super smooth and thick, and it's a lot sweeter than a normal Negroni too. And it's become one of my favorite things.
Road trip to Chicago.
We need to go to Chicago.
Yeah. Okay. And then can we stay with you, Paul? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, anytime. Yeah.
So from liquor.com, loosely translated, a Boulevardier is a man about town. A cocktail by the same name was created by Erskine Gwynn, the publisher of Boulevardier, a magazine for expats living in Paris in the 1920s. The drink was popularized after it was included in proofread this for all the names I had to pronounce. McElhone's 1927 book, Barflies and Cocktails. Employing whiskey, sweet vermouth, and Campari, the Boulevardier is simply a variation on the classic Negroni, which we've already covered, that is adored for its deft balance of bitter, boozy, and sweet. The difference in flavor, however, is anything but simple. The gin-based Negroni is crisp and bracing, and the whiskey-based Boulevardier is rich and warming. It's the exact drink you want to reach for on a chilly fall or winter evening. And then it says to choose your ingredients wisely. And liquor.com mentions that unlike the Negroni, their recipe has a little bit more whiskey, and that's to outbalance the bitterness of the Campari. So I always think the best drink recipe is the one you like the best. So if you like equal parts, then do it that way.
I love that. This feels like a very classy cocktail. A man about town.
A man about town. In Paris in the 1920s.
In Paris, yes.
All right. So let's talk about you, Paul.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your musical journey. You mentioned you're a flutist. What other instruments do you play? Some influential teachers along your path?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up in Nevada originally, and I think that it was a very interesting time, like trying to be a classical musician while I was growing up in Reno, which is not like a small city, but I think it's also a place where there was not a huge classical music scene either. And I feel so grateful for the opportunities I got, like playing in youth orchestra, and I think really sort of starting to begin to see what the wider world of classical music was when I was there. I also think that I had a kind of mixed musical upbringing in that I grew up playing the flute in youth orchestra and taking flute lessons and doing all of the sort of typical classical music things. But at the same time, and maybe even more so in middle school and high school, I played a lot of pop music, and I grew up playing like piano and bass guitar and singing in bands. And yeah, there's some recordings of terrible indie bands I was in like 2012 that are on the internet, different places, unfortunately. But definitely not. but I do think that this sort of split between like playing popular music and playing classical music, it's still something that very much informs the music that I make today. And I think also the experience of learning to play popular music entirely by ear in this very sort of collaborative way where we're all kind of teaching each other things. I think that's still a really important part of my music making today as well.
Cool. I love that.
Can I ask you a question, Paul?
Yeah, go for it.
So now that you're now established in Chicago and a bigger city and you have all these influences and things, do you ever return back to Reno and have any sort of collaboration, or do you revisit that community in some way and see anything, if anything has changed since when you grew up?
That's a great question. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently too, because this year coming up, I have like a bunch of opportunities and things that I'm doing back in my hometown, which is really sort of special. And I think for me, it's always really nice because it's where my parents live. So I get to visit and make a trip of it. But I think it's also something I'm really passionate about, because seeing these opportunities come up, they're the sorts of things that I wish were around when I was a kid.
Right.
Too. So this next year, I'm having a piece of mine played by the Reno Philharmonic, which is like going to be really fun and special. There's also a really amazing group of musicians in Reno who've started a new music ensemble there, which is like exactly the sort of thing that like I would have gone to every show if I was around now. I've like been collaborating with them for a couple years and really trying to support them in whatever way I can. I also have a project where I'm actually writing a cello concerto this year for a cellist who teaches at University of Nevada, Demetria Tappan.
Nice.
So I'm super excited to work with him on that. But for me, it's just so special to like be coming back to this place where I grew up and feeling like I'm contributing to the community there.
Just out of my own like personal curiosities, the cello concerto, like a traditional cello concerto for orchestration, or is it actually a different ensemble mixture?
So this version of the concerto is going to be for cello and like chamber ensemble, like I think cello and eight instruments.
Okay.
But I think the idea is we're going to eventually make it into like a larger orchestration.
Gotcha. Too. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for it. And I love writing for cello too. It's one of my favorite things. Yeah.
So this next question comes from a female perspective, but I realize that body image isn't just a female thing. So do you feel any pressure to look a certain way as a performer or as a composer/writer?
I think that there is a lot of that pressure. And I think that it's something that maybe I don't feel as potently as a lot of other people in my field, just because I'm white and I'm a man. But that being said, I think that this is something that I have a lot of friends who've really felt an amount of pressure on them, both within the classical music field and pressure from people who like are not in that field. There's an idea of what a composer should look like. Yeah, and I think that idea tends to look like very straight and very white and very masculine. I mean, the reality is that there are so many people making incredible music who don't look that way at all. Yeah, I think that in terms of my relationship to performing right now, that's something that I have been really trying to navigate. And I think that a couple years ago, if you had asked me, I would have said that I am a performer, I'm a composer performer, and my performing is just as important to me. And then I sort of had a shift during the pandemic where I didn't play for almost 2 straight years. And only recently I've been coming back to it. And there's been a couple things that have changed. One is that I feel like I enjoy it a lot more, like maybe because it feels like there's less pressure on it. I have less to prove. I'm just doing it more for me. I think I've been enjoying it a lot more. But I think at the same time, I also feel a sort of sadness that maybe that part of my identity isn't there anymore. So yeah, I think that's something that I hope to... hope to navigate and hope to make clearer in the next couple years.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something I've been running into, and I'm sure this is something that both of you as like busy musicians who do lots of different things and host podcasts and all of this feel, is that sometimes it's amazing to be doing all of these different things. But at another point, you sort of have to pick and choose sometimes too. And that's something I feel like I've been running into. It's like, well, I could be writing this piece that I need to write, or I could practice. And I usually pick the piece I'm working on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you might have answered this already, but what is your favorite instrument that you don't play?
Ooh. So I think I have a couple answers to this question. And I think that, maybe the really diplomatic answer is that I think my favorite instrument is whatever I'm writing for at the time. And I try and will just immerse myself in the world of that instrument and really try and figure out my very personal way of approaching that instrument. And for me, that's a huge part of composing, is like that act of immersion. I think just in terms of like my personal preferences over the last couple years, I love writing for cello and bass. Like the low string instruments just have such an expressivity, but also just a range in terms of the techniques you can do, the registers you can do, the sound worlds of the cello and bass are some of my favorite things. I love writing for percussion for a similar reason. Like I think that when you're writing for percussion, it can be anything. It's not even limited to percussion instruments. Anything can be a percussion instrument. So that's always a really special thing. And in a similar vein, I think collaborating with percussionists, they're just kind of down to do anything. They're like, oh, you want to try playing this with this like thing that's not an instrument? Cool, let's do it. Yeah. And then I think really a theme in my work the last couple years has been writing for voice too. And something I'll probably talk a little bit more is like my love of text and text setting. And there's something really special about working with a performer who their instrument is their body. And like, that's a very vulnerable place to be working, but it's also a really magical and special one. And so, I think I really love collaborating with vocalists and writing pieces that really feels like they're very personal to them.
Yeah. So frankly, I'm kind of surprised that you didn't say the flute.
Yeah. Oh, I hate writing for flute. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I think I love writing for flute too. And it feels in one way like it's sort of at home. But actually in another way, I think it feels more difficult sometimes than writing for other instruments.
I was going to ask that. Like, is there a particular instrument that you find actually very challenging to write for one reason or another?
Yeah. I mean, I think flute is certainly up there. And I think part of it is that I feel limited by like
you know
my
too
own.
Much almost.
I know too much. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Or like often I'll stop myself from writing things when I'll be like, oh, this actually seems like maybe it's hard and I don't want to play this. And I mean, maybe I should have that thought more often when I'm writing for other instruments too.
Yeah. Right.
Patty knows. Yeah. She's played my music. Yeah. In terms of other instruments that are hard to write for, I don't know. I mean, I just finished a huge project with harp, which is an instrument I really love writing for. And I love just the resonance of the instrument, how every sound you make just sort of extends out into the world. And at the same time, I think that it's, for me, an extremely difficult instrument to write for, because often you limit the notes that you can have just by the physics of the instrument and the mechanics of the instrument. I think it presents a lot of compositional challenges. I don't know. It's an interesting place to be working from, but it's difficult too. Sometimes you're like writing a section of music and you're like, oh God, I just really want a C natural in there. And there's just no way you can have a C natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My analogy was going to be like, is every instrument a different kind of puzzle that you're sort of trying to negotiate around a bit?
Yeah. I like that metaphor a lot. Yeah. I think writing for every instrument for me just feels very different too. Cause different things feel comfortable on them and different things, I don't know. Like something I'm really interested in is how every instrument presents its own kind of geography of space and you have to navigate it in a different way. So I think in that way it is like a puzzle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an awesome metaphor though.
I like that too. Yeah. And you can always tell, at least as a violinist, you can always tell when a pianist wrote your music because it's just God. Like
Brahms. Like,
yeah.
So much of Brahms music is like, that's just so pianistic.
Right.
Doesn't work on cello.
Yeah, I'm playing a musical right now and there's just some stuff that I'm like, I'm sure this sounded really great on the piano, but it's just like almost impossible to play.
Wow. Can I ask what musical it is? Or is that too shady?
No, it's The Pajama Game.
Oh, I don't know that. Cool though. I feel I love playing in pits a lot. Like that's so much fun. And I don't know. It's so cool, especially when you're positioned in a way where you can actually see what's happening on stage.
I am. I'm on stage. We're like under part of the set. So yeah.
That's awesome. Are you like in costume too?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
We've had one rehearsal with the orchestra and then Sitzprobe yesterday. So one of the things I'm disappointed about though is I can't play games on my phone and I can't have snacks during the show.
Oh no. And those rehearsals are long too, right? Like definitely. It's sort of nice being out of view sometimes too.
It is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we can make faces at each other when things go wrong or, you know, whatever.
Right. Less exposed.
But I'll get more of the story this way, I'm sure. Would you ever consider writing for unaccompanied violin?
I have a piece for unaccompanied violin.
You do?
Yeah, and it's actually a really interesting piece. So right at the very beginning of the pandemic, like a lot of other composers, it was at a time when writing for ensemble was just not really possible because everyone was quarantined by themselves. And right around the beginning of the pandemic, I think I was just feeling this sort of immense grief for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think that the pandemic hit during my senior year of college, and I ended up kind of losing the end of my college and the beginning of grad school for that reason. But I think also, like, I was feeling like there were all of these things I had really wanted to do that ended up getting canceled. And I think sort of fueled by that sense of grief, I started writing a series of solo and duo pieces for a bunch of friends just around the world to work on. Just to like record, and we worked on them a little bit virtually, but really it was more just kind of an expression of love for my friends being like, hey, I miss you and I want to see you. And here's like a little something to let you know I'm thinking about you. What was so interesting is that even though these were tiny little pieces, they were between like 1 and 2 minutes usually, really miniatures, so many of them ended up becoming the blueprints of pieces that I have written in the last couple years. And this solo violin piece, which I wrote for a friend of mine named Connor Tchaikovsky at Rice, became the blueprint for, or in many ways at least, became the blueprint for the string quartet that Patty has played of mine called A String Quartet Is Like a Flock of Birds. And actually the same thing has happened with other pieces that I wrote. And those pieces I ended up kind of collecting together into a set called Dances and Prayers in Isolation from the beginning of the pandemic.
Cool, I love that. The pandemic is actually what got me more interested in unaccompanied violin music as well.
Yeah. I feel like for so many people, it seems like we had to really adapt our practice and our music making during the pandemic. And so many people, I think, did it in a way that was really restorative and beautiful.
Yeah.
Can I ask another sort of pseudo question in line with this question about if you would write for solo violin? I sort of have a composer-esque question that harkens back to Brahms's reverence to Beethoven and his resistance to write a symphony or a string quartet for so long in his career because he thought, well, crap, Beethoven did it already kind of thing. How can I add to the canon? And I don't I don't mean to necessarily say that, you know, like that was just Brahms's reaction, right? Historical reaction to it. But I'm curious from a composer's perspective, what it is like to add to the canon of something that has been like violin solo that has been so prominent and noteworthy, like pop. Well, even people know Bach Partita Number 3, like, you know, probably without knowing it, you know?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, first of all, that's an awesome question. And I think it's something I
know it's a hard
about.
One. I'm yeah. sorry.
No. I think that I don't know that I feel like this huge sense of anxiety about it, but I do think it is something that I react to in a lot of ways mm-hmm. in my music. And something that I think a lot about is reacting to the grandiosity of a lot of the music that came before by writing pieces that are actually really tiny. And for me, I feel like that's a big part of the music that I make is even when I'm writing a longer piece, often what it is it's a bunch of miniatures that are connected. I'm really fond of miniatures, and I feel like small things are really at the heart of the music that I make. So, like, for example, in the string quartet that you've played, which is called A String Quartet is Like a Flock of Birds, and the other three pieces I have for string quartet, for me, the string quartet is like this incredibly grandiose genre of music where composers have often made their biggest statements. Like I think of Beethoven and Brahms and so many of these, and Shostakovich, so many of these composers, their most personal and their kind of biggest statements have been through the string quartet. And there is something really intimidating about that. And I think that one of the ways that I sort of react to that is by writing string quartets, which are actually tiny. They're pieces that are not grandiose at all. All of my string quartets are in many, many very short movements rather than these much bigger musical landscapes. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of one way of reacting to or approaching the canon like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that for me, it really sort of depends what it is. Because I think that one of the things that was really special that happened in the 20th century was just that composers started approaching genres of music in so many different ways that it felt like in some ways that weight of the canon had been lifted. Because now you could kind of do anything. And you could go from like the way that Brahms and Beethoven were approaching these genres to just the wackiest and most out there and experimental things. And so I think in some ways, maybe it feels like that weight of the past has been lifted.
Yeah.
Yeah, so speaking of genre, how would you define your genre / should you define your genre?
That's such a great question. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think genre is a really complicated thing because to define your genre, that can be a really sort of liberating act, but also it means you're sort of categorizing yourself. So you're putting yourself in a box. And I feel like that idea of being both liberating but also maybe limiting is it's complicated, yeah. And I think that it's something that I feel very potently, maybe because I make music that could be said is at the intersection of classical music and experimental music too. Like about half the pieces I work on, I write for people who would call themselves classical musicians and have that training and have that particular disciplinary background. And then the other half I write for people who would probably call themselves like new musicians, like they mostly play experimental music and are improvisers and do a lot of interdisciplinary stuff and play with electronics a lot. And I feel like that is connected to classical music, but it feels like it's in many ways a different discipline. And I think in many ways, what I do is sort of like right at the intersection of those two things or right in between them.
So this is something I've been kind of struggling with. I would call myself a classical musician, but I do many more things. Like right when we're finished recording, I'm going to go play in a Cuban band on Easter. It's going to be great. But I don't think classical is a great term for the music that we play because it really isn't. Do you have any ideas for what would be a better term for classical music?
That's such a great question. I know it's one that many, many people who are smarter than me have argued about a lot. Also, playing in a Cuban band sounds awesome. What a great way to celebrate
Easter. It's fun.
I think that a term that I hear used a lot now is concert music, like music that was meant to be played in a concert hall. And I feel like in many ways that feels more accurate. Yeah, like it actually provides somewhat of a clearer definition of the traditional music that we're all trained in. Some other things that I hear thrown around, I hear people say Western art music, which I hate. I really don't like when people say that because first of all, like what does Western mean? Like it seems very poorly defined and I think arguably sort of a white supremacist concept in certain ways. And then art music, I maybe even hate even more, because, like, as opposed to all the music that isn't art, like, I don't know. To me, it just feels, like, weirdly judgmental, and, like, you're trying to put this genre and tradition of music above, like, all other traditions. So I tend to like concert music. When I'm teaching, I'll often say common practice era music, like if I'm teaching about tonality or something, because I think then... At least people usually will know what you're talking about when you say that. But yeah, I agree that classical music, even though I think it's probably the most common phrase that people use, is a problematic phrase. Yeah.
Yeah, for many reasons. I like concert music. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah. I think that I think something, in many ways, it's a really clear term. But then I think the problem is, like, what if you are playing in a string quartet and you're not in a concert hall? Does that make it not the same kind of music? Yeah. So I think all of these terms are loaded in different ways. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, chamber music came from performing in a chamber or a room.
Right. Yeah. And I think there's such a long history of the music that we make being shaped by the spaces that we're making it in, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, it's such an interesting conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Who would you say are your biggest musical influences?
That's an awesome question. And I think it's, I don't know. I mean, I think that, like I said, I had this very sort of mixed musical upbringing, and I grew up playing classical music and listening to a lot of classical music, and doing the same with pop music. So I think that, like, some of the composers who have, like, really loomed pretty large for me are Toru Takemitsu, the Japanese composer, whose music continues to be kind of like a touchstone for me. Same thing with Henri Dutilleux, the French composer. And I think a certain kind of legacy of French music making in the 20th century, so of Messiaen and also of Debussy and Ravel. I would say that in terms of some people making music right now, whose music I just absolutely adore, Katie Balch is a composer who I just really love every piece she writes. Igor Santos is another. Those are a couple composers, at least, whose music I constantly come back to. In terms of kind of more on the pop music side, I, like, really grew up playing folk music and listening to a certain type of folk music. And so, like, Sufjan Stevens is an artist who I keep coming back to. Same thing with Bon Iver and the band Big Thief. Are some of those groups where I sort of feel like they're really interested in, I would say, like, shattering traditional songwriting and doing things that go beyond just the traditional kind of storytelling that we get in folk music, but also really kind of embracing that tradition, too. So, I hope that sort of answers your question.
Totally. And it gives me some new people to look into, too.
Can I just comment quickly on... specifically Bon Iver. First of all, he lives in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I don't know if anyone knows that. So it's, like, actually quite close to both of us in some ways. And it's like, oh my God, he's, like, right around the corner. But I stumbled onto his music because of Taylor Swift, because there's two tracks on Folklore and Evermore that he sings on with her that does a duet, and it's gorgeous. But I also feel like, After listening to those tracks, I went and tried to look into his music more, and I've just been transfixed by how he uses his voice and how he voice leads in his songs. It's just like, what other person is doing this right now, kind of in the pop or folk genre? It's it's just so beautiful in its own way. And he has such a low voice, so he can really go that low, and then he can also do this beautiful falsetto that just, you know, it's just the mixtures of all those. Anyway, I don't know if you get inspired like I do with that, but.
I do. I'm like kind of obsessed with Bon Iver a little bit. I also feel like both him and Sufjan Stevens are truly like Midwest musicians.
Yeah.
Like that's like such a core part of their identity, which I adore. I've like wanted to go to his music festival every year in Eau Claire for the last couple years, and it's like never worked out. But one of these years I really want to go. It just seems really magical.
Yeah.
And I totally agree. Like, I feel like he has one of the most distinctive voices that I've ever heard. And I think he also uses it unlike any other musician.
Anyone. The only other person that could possibly, like, in some range way come close is like Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. But that's just because he has such a low voice, you know?
Yeah. There's another musician who I like a lot, who actually is really good friends with Justin Vernon of Bon Iver, named Moses Sumney, who I think does something kind of similar to...
Uh-huh.
And for him, one of the things that I love about it is that it often, he's using his voice and it's making kind of commentary about gender. Like, mm-hmm. so he has right. like the highest falsetto, but also an incredibly low voice and is mm-hmm. constantly moving between those ranges. And Oh, Moses Sumney is amazing. And Bon Iver is amazing. They're both so great. Yeah.
Kind of taking a left turn. What song or piece are you most proud of that you've written?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces that I've worked on that I'm proud of in different ways. And I think that sometimes I'm proud of something because it feels like it was just a huge accomplishment to have done. Like it feels really big. But I think there's other pieces I've written that feel like they're really new for me. And so that feels like it's something I'm really proud of because it's pushing me in a new direction. I think that there was a piece I wrote in 2019 called As the Light Begins to Drift, which was a piece for Sinfonietta that I wrote for like a bunch of my closest friends at Rice when I was there for undergrad. And that piece is one that I think continues to be one that I'm really proud of, partly just because it feels like it's a really big piece that does a lot of things and does them pretty well. And I think it sort of felt like a statement for me in that way. And I think it's sort of become like a calling card piece. I think that in the last couple of years, my music has gone in a very different direction, though, and has become much more lyrical, much more, I would say, expressive, but also kind of more tonal and pretty, too. A big part of that is because I've been writing for voice so often the last few years, and a piece that I'm really proud of in kind of that vein is a piece called Birds the Binding Of that I wrote last year for the amazing Midwest group Quince Ensemble, amazing vocal group. And I think for me, it's a piece I'm proud of because it uses voices in a way that I never had before, but still in a way that feels very personal. And also maybe even more so because it was written in collaboration with a really good friend of mine who I've worked with a bunch of times, whose name is Ira Goga. They're a really wonderful poet. So that's a piece that I think is really special.
Can't remember. I'm so sorry. Do we get to hear some of that today?
We do. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, great. Great, great. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks. Yeah.
I promise this next question is related, even though it doesn't seem that way at first.
Okay.
Did you see the movie Eurovision?
I didn't, no.
Oh, okay. So there's a song in there called Ya Ya Ding Dong that like every time they go out and perform, they have to sing it like at least twice. They're just like annoyed. I was wondering if there's a song like, or a piece like that for you that you feel like people request all the time and you're just like so over it.
That's such an interesting question. And I think that part of it is that whenever people want to hear my music, I'm like, oh my God, yes, you can do anything. This is something that composers feel really differently about. Like, I think for some people, they sort of feel a real sense of ownership over their music in that, like, if there's a piece that they feel like they've kind of moved beyond or aren't happy with, they'll pull it from their catalog and not let people play it anymore. Mm. I feel like for me, something that has, I think, been really important to me in my approach is that once a piece is done, I sort of feel like it's out there in the world and it's not for me anymore. It's for the people I wrote it for. And if they want to keep playing it, that's awesome. And even if there's things that I am not happy with about it, clearly someone is liking it if they still want to play it. So that's sort of been my approach. I think that like a piece that a lot of people actually have been talking to me about is this string quartet I wrote a couple years ago. A string quartet is like a flock of birds, which is the one Patty's played. And I think one reason for that. Yeah, it keeps coming up. Yeah. Another bird related piece, which is another kind of theme for me. I love birds. I think one reason that becomes a piece that it feels like, at least to me, a lot of people know me for is because it was featured on this YouTube channel called Score Follower, which I'm not sure, this might be a composer specific thing, but that a lot of composers watch where they post score videos. And it's for me, especially growing up in a place where there wasn't a lot of contemporary music, to be able to like just go in and see all these cool scores and hear recordings of them was like such a cool way to learn. And so it was really special to have my piece featured on that channel last year. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool.
It is a, excuse me. It is a very effective piece though, Paul. Like, I don't know if you feel badly about it or not, but and it is challenging to put together, like, let's just be real, but once you get it, like as in from the performer's perspective, like once it clicks, it's like, it's really kind of like magical and sparkly. And I like to think of it a lot as like fireworks, like a lot of some of the fast movement faster movements, I should say, or there's a lot of these little scales that, you know, we all have to play, and they burst into this sort of thing. And I just feel like every time we start those scales, it's like we're just shooting up one more firework and it just goes off. But I don't know if that's probably not what at all what you're thinking, but that's how it feels to play, I guess.
I love that. And thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, yeah. I appreciate that a lot. And I think the way that you played it, and also the recording that's coming out with Kinetic next year, I'm so excited for. Yeah.
I'm so excited and also nervous. Because, it's me and my colleagues from Kinetic, if I can just, you know, give them some credit as well. Tanya Burton on viola, Sam Park on violin, and Jacob Schaefer on violin as well.
Yeah, and I think that, like, just the amount of work, but also the amount of personality that all of these musicians brought to this piece is really special, and to be able to be there for the recording was also really cool for me, and to, like, I think just to be a part of that process was a really special thing.
Yeah. We're in the phases right now of just listening back to the final masters and just making any sort of, like, if you hear one little thing out, and so it's like we're still under the microscope a bit, but it's, you know, it's all overall, it's after listening to it, it's like, wow, this is really cool. It's awesome to have been a part of it.
Yeah. I feel like it's so interesting thinking about how different the process of recording is from performing too, just because I think, at least for me as a performer, like when I'm learning a piece, the way that we're trained is we try and think about the big picture of the piece, right? Like, how does this section connect to this section? And it's almost the opposite when you're recording. Like, you work on things in such tiny chunks that, it's such a different way of thinking.
Yeah, definitely.
We have talked quite a bit about a string quartet is like a flock of birds. So we thought we'd start by sharing a little bit of that piece with you. Paul, did you want to say something, or did you want to listen to it first?
Let's listen to it first.
Okay. Yeah.
Patty's anxiety just listening to this, which I think we recorded so many times like a couple months ago when we were doing this.
Well, you chose Asia like one, well, maybe the second hardest spot in that quartet too. So
I can see, like, how that's hard to put together. Yeah. It sounds so cool, but
oh no, totally.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah, that's where I nothing, no shade or anything. It's just like, yeah. But I want to just be upfront about this particular recording was the premiere recording of it with Kinetic, but I wasn't available because we were socially distanced for 2020, and so it was actually my colleague David Olson who was the cellist on that. And Siggy Yap was the violist as well.
Right. Yeah, and I was just saying to Patty that I love when different groups of musicians play my pieces too and have a really different interpretation. And I think it is true that you and David had like super different interpretations of this piece,
oh, we
which
did.
were Well, no, but like in a cool way. Like I thought it was really special to hear, and I think it makes it more personal too. That like you're each approaching this in a different way.
Yeah.
So this section of music comes towards the end of the piece. Like I said, I often approach string quartets as like these interconnected, very short movements. And this is actually the ninth movement of nine movements in the piece. This was actually the first section of music that I wrote too, of the string quartet. I think
that explains everything.
I actually, I know you had more to say about it, but I was curious if this is part of that quartet that's inspired by your unaccompanied piece.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, okay. It absolutely is. Yeah. And so this section of music, I think, really gets at the heart of something that I try and do in a lot of my pieces, which is write music which requires a heightened level of what I call collective virtuosity, where it requires a lot of artistic teamwork, like really on a virtuosic level. But it's not the individual parts that are difficult. It's the fitting together process and the being attuned to each other and really listening and feeling together as a group, which is challenging. And for me, that's like something that I try and do in a lot of my music. And I think it certainly is challenging to put together. Yeah, it's like using a musical technique called Hockett, so where the different parts are fitting together kind of like a puzzle. And I think often the rehearsal process is like putting together that puzzle a little bit. You asked about the unaccompanied violin piece. So that the unaccompanied violin piece was kind of like this groovy ricochet etude sort of piece, and a lot of the previous sections in this piece are this kind of ricochet groove, which is taken pretty much directly from that.
Well, you had me at groove, you lost me at ricochet.
Almost had you, yeah.
Almost had me.
Well, can I ask, since there is a lot of ricochet in a string quartet, it's like a flock of birds. Is there something specific about that technique as like a string technique that you find really appealing, or like, is it something that maybe a lot of composers haven't really just dived into yet? Kind of like an area that is slightly undiscovered, or why are you using ricochet is essentially my question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I certainly would not claim to be the first person who has discovered ricochet, and I think lots of composers have used it in really different, interesting ways. For me personally, I love the sense of noise that you get with it. Like, it's a very standard playing technique, but when you actually have the bow bouncing, you're not mostly hearing pitch, you're mostly hearing bow noise, which I think is really cool. And I think it creates this much more blurry sound. I also love that ricochet is one of these techniques which you can, it takes a lot of practice, but you can do it and get it very rhythmically precise. But naturally, I think it's very rhythmically imprecise. Like, it's a very free gesture, almost like kind of more improvisatory. And so I think those are a couple of the reasons that I really like it.
And you're telling me now.
I think it's actually like one of my friends and I have this joke that like whenever we're writing for string instruments, the entire part is just ricochets and Bartok pizzas, because those are like the new music cliches of writing for strings, I think.
And artificial harmonics.
Artificial harmonics, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's like so much of new music is just doing ricochets and like air sound. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, I love ricochet, and for me it feels like it's a very expressive gesture visually too, like just the throwing of the bow feels like it's a kind of choreography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh. Okay. Maybe I'll have to dive a little deeper into ricochet. But yeah, I mean, I totally get it. Like, one of the things I love about the violin and all string instruments is that we have so many options to make different sounds.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. And that's part of why writing for strings for me is just so much fun. Like the even if you're just playing a single note, the different like textures and sounds and colors you can get on that note are pretty infinite, I think. And I think that in a certain way, this string quartet in particular is kind of like each of the different miniatures is kind of like a different effect that you can get on really the same notes. There's not that many different notes in this piece, and it's more just different variations in color and texture.
Well, yeah. So that was the first bit of your music that I've ever heard. And I have access to the full recording, so I can't wait to go back and listen to all of it.
Thank you. Thanks so much for saying that.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about this piece?
I guess something else I could talk a little bit about is birds and what the title means and what birds mean in my music in general. So I think that this piece is one of the first of a couple of pieces that I've written that really have this idea of collective virtuosity kind of built into their DNA. And for me, this idea of like the kind of chamber music, the artistic team being the most important thing, which to me feels very separate than like the standard kind of virtuosity that we hear in classical or concert music, is I feel like in like a lot of concert music, when we think of virtuosity, we think of like the cadenza of a piano concerto or something, right? We think of like a soloist being virtuosic. But I think that my experience playing music is that the real virtuosity that happens is between the people on stage. And so I really try and write music that brings that to the forefront. And for me, birds are like a really important metaphor for that. And one reason is that like in a flock of birds, there's not a leader. Like everyone is kind of taking turns being the leader and the follower. And that was sort of the central metaphor of this piece. And I think you'll hear that that's very much true throughout the course of it. That and it's true in a lot of chamber music, that you sort of take turns and you're always listening and sometimes following and sometimes leading.
Can I love that metaphor.
Thanks. I want to ask a silly question, though. What kind of bird did you have in mind?
I think, like, I was thinking a lot about, like, geese flying, like flocks of geese. Maybe that's a very Midwestern metaphor, too, because you always see the geese migrating.
The Canadian geese, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But there's a video artist who made a piece which has, like, this as a soundtrack. And he was thinking, like, songbirds, too. And I kind of love that idea, too.
I was thinking of the, I can't remember what they're called, but the crow-like blackbirds that surround Houston.
Oh, the grackles?
Yes. I was thinking of those as we were playing it. That's like not what you were thinking of, probably, though, right?
I love that. And also grackles are like famously so annoying too. So what do you think of my music, Patty?
No, it's wonderful. That's not what I meant. No, I just, maybe because I just tie that piece and tie you and where you are, where we met in our lives in Houston. And so maybe that's where it came from. Plus, yeah, they're just everywhere. Yeah. They're all around rice, you know, so.
Right, right. And actually, I think that is so important to say, too, because one of the really important aspects of this piece is that I was writing it for this wonderful group, Kinetic, which I have such a close attachment to and know the members of really well. And one of the reasons for that Kinetic was, like, I think really coming to its own when I was a student at Rice in Houston, where Patty also was a student and started playing with Kinetic. And I was an intern for Kinetic for 3 years before I wrote this piece, actually, and was doing admin work and librarian work. And so I feel like this is a group that I feel like this really intense collaboration with. Like, these aren't strangers. These are people that actually know really well.
Yeah.
All right, shall we listen to another?
Yep.
Awesome, let's do it. So this is a piece for Sinfonietta called As the Light Begins to Drift from 2019. And this is the premiere recording by Here and Now Ensemble at Rice, conducted by Joshua Hong.
That collective virtuosity there.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I feel like in many ways, this piece is doing something kind of similar, where it's taking not that many notes and just doing very kaleidoscopic colors using that simple pitch material. I think that for me, one of the things that's most fun about writing this piece is that I was writing similar to the string quartet, actually, for like a really close group of friends. This was kind of for my like closest friends in undergrad. And I knew all of their playing so well, and I think got to kind of craft it for them in a very kind of distinctive way. And I think also really incorporate their personalities into each of the instrumental parts too, which was fun.
Yeah, I like this one note idea, and it made me think of the technique that was used often in Debussy's music, the Klangfarben, which is such an ugly word for such a beautiful thing that happens in music, where one note is shared between two instruments and you kind of hear the color change from, like, for example, between in Debussy's trio for harp, flute, and viola, like between the flute and the viola, just like passing one note. So, absolutely.
Yeah, for me, Klangfarben melody feels like it's a very related technique actually to what I was talking about before, Hockett. Like, where Hockett is usually, we think of it with being like staccato notes, and Klangfarben we think about being sustained. But I think in many ways they're kind of the same idea. Like, it's that we have just this very simple melody that's being shared and orchestrated in a way that's much more complex. I think that's something I think about a lot in my music.
Can you tell us a little bit about the title of this piece?
Sure. So this piece is called As the Light Begins to Drift. And in some ways, it's sort of an abstract title. But what I was thinking about when I was writing this piece was about the really kind of complicated and interesting cloud patterns that we would get in Houston sometimes, where it was like often kind of raining really hard while it was sunny, and we'd have a tornado warning, but like the sun was shining. There was all sorts of stuff like that. And for me, I was kind of thinking about, in particular, this image of the sun shining through this very stormy clouds. And I think that, like, that became like a central orchestrational image in this piece. And so often there's these very stormy textures with a lot of things sort of swirling around in them. And then there's like these little points of light where everyone kind of lines up. And so that sort of became one of the inspirations of the piece.
Cool. Shall we listen to another?
Yeah, awesome. And I can introduce it here. So This is Birds, the Binding Of for vocal quartet, here performed by Quince Ensemble. Awesome. That was a great ending spot there too. This piece, it had its inception when my really close friend and longtime poet collaborator Ira Goga reached out to me, and they said, like, hey, I'm working on this project which is very strange and witchy. Would you like to be a part of it?
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, I'm intrigued. That sounds awesome. What they were working on was they were creating poetry from this taxidermy manual from the 17th century, which they had found. And they were right, it was very strange and witchy. But they were taking this language, which was in many ways, like, just objectively kind of gross, like about parts of the body and all the chemicals you use in preserving and different kinds of animals. And then they were turning it into this thing which was absolutely beautiful. And something that we talked about a lot as we were working on this piece together was that, and bear with me here, this is going to sound kind of weird, but that there's something like deeply queer about taxidermy, in that you're taking something which is sort of gross and bodily, and then you're transforming it into something which is actually sort of beautiful and personal and new. I think the phrase that Ira used was queer alchemy, which I really love. And this process of like taking something apart and putting it back together again in the wrong order, which I think is sort of at the heart of taxidermy and is also how Ira made the poem. Like they rearranged the words of this taxidermy manual. That was sort of my process in making this piece. And it's something that sort of unfolds over the scope of the whole piece. But here at the very beginning that we heard, what we're hearing is just individual phonemes and syllables from the poem that have sort of been taken apart and are put together in kind of the wrong order, and then gradually sort of reassembles into words and phrases. But sometimes those words and phrases are also not in the right order. And this idea of like taking things apart into their individual sounds and then reassembling them, I felt was really important. And then I think it's also something that I was trying to do kind of orchestrationally and rhythmically too. And so there's a lot of textures in this piece where it feels like something has been taken apart and the different parts are putting it back together.
Yeah, I was really taken by, I'm taken by all your music, Paul. Don't get me wrong.
Thank you.
But I found it very interesting, especially now understanding this taxidermy, backstory and things like that. That's very clever, actually, to do in certain ways, because so much of what vocalists work on is diction and speech, and trying to get that message across. But then that's part of, as you say, the whole process of taxidermy, et cetera, et cetera. But I also found that what was really fun is, since we talked about ricochet so much in A String Quartet Is Like a Flock of Birds, that you kind of did that with the voice. And I found that there's a very unique difference in vocal ricochet, if you say, like a stuttering or whatever, than there was to strings. And that it's, one similar concept of just sort of throwing your voice or throwing a bow can have such different wide variety of possibilities in the palette on its own.
Yeah, I love that. I think that that connection is absolutely right, that like the da 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 thing, that's like totally a ricochet. Yeah, it's like a vocal ricochet.
Is it even written the same?
It's almost, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a vocal composer. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that something that Ira and I talked a lot about in this piece was the idea of incantation. And so for me, this felt like it's almost like you're like reciting a spell and making these weird sounds as part of this spell or potion or something. And later on in the piece, the text is recited really, really quickly. It's almost like becomes this sort of babble, which is all the different parts are doing it on top of each other. And it feels like you're doing part of like a ritual or something. So I think for me, it was almost like part of this like very witchy, magical kind of imagery.
Yeah. Something also that really captured me, at least in the, and maybe that's the word I should say, is that in all your music that I've heard so far, that there's something about it that catches my attention almost instantly. It doesn't take me a bit to get into it. And I'm sure that's something that you're very conscious of and you plan for. That's not an accident, right?
I think maybe part of it is that I have a very short attention span too. But I first of all, I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. Yeah. And I think that, it's something that I really think about a lot. And one of the ways that I think about that is that I am always trying to balance the parameters. So if like there's not very much going on rhythmically wise, something else interesting needs to be happening to make up for that. If there's, like, for example, in these examples, there's not very much going on pitch-wise. Like, it starts out with just one note in this piece.
Right.
But I think to make up for that, there has to be something really interesting happening with the language they're using and the sounds they're making.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that idea of, like, if something is simple, something else has to be complex and vice versa. Because I think if everything is too complex, you can't tell what's going on, too. That's something I think a lot about when I'm working. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say for a vocal quartet, this is not what I expected to hear. Like, I loved just the way you used the voice as also a not vocalist. Like, I mean, I have my karaoke moments, but like, I don't think about like the extended range of vocal techniques. So that was really fun to hear.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I think part of it too is that I was working on this piece with Quince Ensemble, who are just like amazing new music people. Like they're all fantastic singers in their own right, but also they come together and just sing like some of the hardest music that I've ever heard, and sing it so well and so powerfully. And in particular, they love doing this kind of rhythmic interplay, which is not something that a lot of vocalists feel comfortable doing. Like it's not something that's asked of in a lot of vocal music the way it is in instrumental music. But they actually have an album called Hockets, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm totally gonna do something in that vein. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. Yeah. And definitely check out Quince if you don't know their work too.
For sure. So this next piece you sent me, I'm very interested in hearing, because I have a fascination with doing chamber music with wind instruments, and just hearing like how you can kind of imitate an orchestra with a smaller ensemble. And I don't know if that's what you're going for, but that's just kind of what I'm always interested in. So this is a piece for clarinet, violin, cello, and piano.
This is Entwining from 2021 for clarinet, violin, cello, and piano, written for and here premiered by Music from Copeland House.
I just don't want to. I just want to keep listening.
I know.
Oh, thank you, Patty. Yeah, I feel like I didn't even realize this as I was picking out these examples, but I really picked all fast music for these, which is so interesting because it's not actually what I would say is the core of my work. Like, I write a lot of very slow, lyrical, and kind of textural music, too. But yeah, these are all sort of among the bops I've written, I would say.
But the bops. But they're all the, I call it, I guess, chamber music virtuosity. You use a different term. But
yeah, the like collective virtuosity. Yeah,
they're all collective virtuosity. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, yeah. And I think they all sort of showcase that in a slightly different way. In this case, I think that just thinking about like the fast music that I was writing, this was written going into the second year of the pandemic. And I think that like it was right around a time when I became very fascinated by the idea of the dance in music too, and what that can mean and how you can have a dance which is sort of broken or fragmented and like maybe not what you'd traditionally expect, but still has that like momentum and that joy in it. And I think that was part of the reason why I started writing so much of these, this like very, very boppy, rhythmic and kind of driving music. This for me fits kind of in the vein of other pieces I've written, which the dance is a really important idea from. And I think that actually, can't remember exactly what the titles of the movements for this piece is, but I'm pretty sure this first movement is called Swirling Dance or something like that. Yeah, and also Music from Copeland House is amazing, and they played this piece so beautifully. Yeah, I'm so happy to have gotten to work with them.
I'm curious if there's a specific type of swirling dance that you were thinking of. If that is in fact the title of the movement.
I'll have to check on that. I can't totally remember. But
I'll fact check.
That's a great question. I mean, I think for me, I'm really fascinated by dances, like I said, where there's something kind of wrong with them, like where nothing is quite in rhythm correctly and you can still kind of feel the joy behind it. And so I think because of that, I'm drawn to a lot of modern dance in particular. Yeah, I don't know if I have the necessarily the vocabulary to talk about it exactly, but something that does connect to actually is that I love working with dancers and choreographers a lot too. As you can maybe see behind me on my wall, I have a poster for a show that we just did with dancers a few weeks ago. But I feel like thinking about movement and music together is a really powerful thing for me.
Oh, totally. I started taking ballet classes a little more seriously once things started opening up again post-pandemic, and it's just been eye-opening for my music making. One of the really special things about the studio I go to is there's a pianist in the room. So we have a live accompanist who's playing for us and can slow the tempo down a little bit if we need to, which I often need. But yeah, I think movement is so removed from our music education. And that's really unfortunate.
It is. It totally is. Also, I feel like that must be such a special experience, too, to be learning ballet as an adult, too. And I can imagine like that informs your music making and vice versa in really special ways.
I think it's also very humbling.
I'm sure if I was in that position, I would feel exactly the same way, too. Yeah, I think that something that I've learned just from working with choreographers and dancers too, is just that the way that they work is so different than the way that musicians work, and especially that composers work. So I think that like the way that the classical music world typically works is that when I'm working on a piece, I write almost all of it before the first rehearsal, right? And then maybe we'll make some little changes in the rehearsal, but largely my actual creative work is kind of done, like it's written on the page by the time we get to that first rehearsal. For choreographers, it's entirely the opposite, and most of them will come to the first rehearsal with dancers and build something with them in the space. And I think part of it is because when you're thinking about choreography, you're working with people's bodies too. It's a very personal and a very vulnerable thing. And so you really have to be there in the space. But honestly, it's something that I wish we had more of that energy in the classical music world. Mm-hmm. I think also there's a real sensitivity to the body that dancers have too, that I think musicians kind of pretend that we're invincible until we get injured, right? Yeah. Like I think I think that like the real sensitivity to what we're doing is actually like athletic is something that I don't know, I feel like we could learn from the dance world.
Yeah, my teacher in undergrad called us Olympians of the small muscle groups, which was just like, he didn't really dive any further into that. But if you think about it, like, I mean, I watch a lot of dancers on YouTube and Instagram and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the way that they take care of themselves is so different than how a lot of musicians do. And it's, I mean, yeah, they're working with large muscle groups, but I mean, the way we develop as humans, like growing from a small baby, is like the big muscle stuff happens first. And then like injury kind of happens backwards. And in my non-medical opinion, like the smaller stuff is probably affected before the bigger stuff.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I love the Olympians of the small muscle group. Yeah, that's such a great phrase.
It made me feel really special.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's so easy to kind of forget the physical part of what we're doing. No matter what kind of music we're making, we're still making it with our body. And that physicality is such a huge part of what we're doing.
Yeah. So we have one more piece from you. And I have to confess, I'm unfamiliar with this ensemble.
Pierrot?
Yeah.
Pierrot is Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire. And it's a specific instrumentation that he... I mean, the thing is, okay, maybe this is where you can help me, Paul, but I don't know if it's specifically he just set this and then people were like, that's a great ensemble, let's just keep doing it. Similar to like a string quartet or something like that. I think the instrumentation is violin/viola, cello, piano, clarinet, flute, singer, or sprechstimme, some spoken. And I feel like I'm forgetting a couple more instruments. Help me out.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And you're totally right that Schoenberg picked this instrumentation, and right around that same time, a bunch of other people, either totally unrelated or were like directly inspired by him and started writing pieces for similar instrumentations, including like Ravel and Stravinsky and a bunch of other people. And it sort of became like this standard instrumentation of the 20th century. And so a lot of
new music or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now like just around the country and the world, there's like a million ensembles with this instrumentation. Now, typically, instead of having a singer, they'll replace it with percussion.
Right.
So that's a pretty standard substitution. So that's groups like Eighth Blackbird.
I was going to say.
Yeah. There's a lot of other groups with that instrumentation too. And so this piece is for a flute, clarinet, violin, cello, piano, percussion. And this is Prisms and Mirrors. And here it is performed by Black Box Ensemble.
So cool.
Thank you. Thanks. Even listening to this gives me anxiety because this is a piece that I've played myself a couple times. And this is like one of the hardest sections of the whole piece too. Just where things always go off the rails just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Black Box is such a good ensemble. They sound amazing doing this.
Yeah. They sounded great.
Yeah. Yeah. This was another piece that I wrote sort of in the early to mid pandemic. So in 2021. And the whole idea of this piece was that I was thinking a lot about the idea of collaboration as being like a light shine through prisms and bouncing off of mirrors, where like every single person you're collaborating with kind of refracts it into different beautiful colors and it sort of changes along the way, but there's also something that sort of stays the same. And so that was sort of the primary metaphor of this piece.
Where there's like one genesis essentially for that. Like exactly. Light is the genesis of all this fracturing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That was also kind of the way that I was thinking about the form of the piece too, where like the light is continuous throughout, but it just keeps fracturing over and over again.
That's kind of the image I got from this clip, and it actually made me think of a Zelda game. I can't remember if it's The Wind Waker or Twilight Princess, but there's this really cool dungeon puzzle where you have to make the light go to one corner of the room and it's only coming from the ceiling, and you have to move all these statues around and like reflect the light. And
sort of I love that.
For that. Too bad they didn't have you back in whenever that game was made.
Right. Right. That feels very Zelda too, which I love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like this idea of things bouncing back and forth is a very, that feels like a very productive image for me. Like that brings a lot of musical things to mind for me. For me, Prisms and Mirrors has sort of become a bit of a calling card piece too, just because I think this instrumentation, like I said, is very common in the music world now. And so I think it's cool to see this piece done like all over the world and hear all the different interpretations of it, which are all really different too, which is cool.
How do you react to different interpretations?
I love it. I mean, like I said, I think I always feel really honored whenever a group wants to perform my music. And I also feel like it's a really special thing when a group does it in a way that no one has ever done it before. Like it's a really different kind of interpretation. It's often feels really different when it's people I know versus people I don't know. Like if it's people I know, I think I don't know, then it feels like it's a really personal thing and it's sort of a way of honoring our friendship. That to me is like such a beautiful thing. On the other hand, I feel like an experience I've been in a lot the last couple of years is working with performers who I really like don't know in a social context at all. I'm just meeting them for the first time at rehearsal. And that like is, I don't know. I think in many ways it's a little bit more impersonal, but I think it's also such a good way to get to know people immediately is to be making music with them.
Right.
Yeah. I always feel a little bit bad in that situation. Cause if like my friends are playing my music, I feel like they at least know me and know that I'm like not going to be mad if they mess things up or anything. But I think sometimes I'll come into a situation and everyone's just really stressed out because the notes and rhythms are so hard. Yeah. I always feel a little bad in those situations.
Yeah. Well, the little that I've done with like totally new premieres, I do feel a lot of pressure to write exactly what, or to play exactly what the composer wrote. And I've always just been astonished. Like in the Sioux City Symphony last season, we premiered a piece by Katia Ghosh, and it was like really hard. Like I had all this high stuff and it was like 5 against 4 and like 6/8 time signature. And I was just like, what is going on? And she just came up every rehearsal and was like, oh, it's great. Could the bassoon be a little louder here? And I was like, huh? Like I did not play what you wrote. Yeah. So I think that's something that I just need to get a little more comfortable with for premieres.
Totally. I think thinking about orchestra and do music is such an interesting world too, because I think that in many ways, like the orchestra world is so geared towards the past and playing music of the past. And I think it's been nice to see in the last couple of years, a lot of orchestras have started doing more new work, which is awesome. But I think at the same time, in many ways, it's a really tough thing to get that large of an ensemble used to performing this new piece in such a short amount of rehearsal. There are some organizations in the country, in the world, that are just like, do this so masterfully and have really taken the initiative and made this like a real, really big part of their mission, which I admire a lot. That sounds so cool too. I'm glad you got to premiere a piece by Kati. Her music is so good.
Yeah, I know there's a recording of it available. I haven't like, I mean, this was October of like, almost 2 years ago now, and I haven't like really removed myself from the stress to listen to it, but I should listen.
Yeah,
I heard it sounded really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. I feel like with so much new music too, and this has been my experience as a performer at least, when you're up on stage playing, you're like, what is even going on here? I'm stressed. I can't tell what's happening. And then you hear a recording of it after, and it turns out it actually all fits together, and it's the sort of thing you can only experience from the audience and not up on stage. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like for me, it's always been a very humbling experience to try and play my own music too. Partly because I think it really makes me feel so strongly the things that I'm asking players to do and exactly what that takes physically and mentally. And I think I'll also say that I think playing the music of my friends too, I really kind of consider myself a new music flutist. And playing the music of my friends has been such a learning experience for me too. And I feel like I've really gotten to know some of my friends better that way.
Something that I've also, in maybe this will be a transition, but something I've in listening to all these little mini clips of your music, something I've learned about you is that there's always a very poignant theme or image or concept or really, there's times where I play other people's music, let's say, and it's just kind of this general sort of like, oh, it's sort of something like this, or like it's up to you to interpret, but it's something that audiences and performers can latch on to, like a concept, and it's very specific. And I think that I don't know if that's from your collaborations with dancers, your collaborations with poets, or things like that, but it's something that I find really interesting. Like I was thinking earlier when you were talking about Birds, the Binding of, that I would never think that a topic that we would discuss or even think about or divulge in is taxidermy, right? And witches, of course, like all this stuff, like that's really thought provoking. And I think that that is an element of your music that's not only just very unique to you and who I know you as, but also something that performers and audiences can really take and really appreciate when they listen to your music.
Yeah, oh, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. And I think it's something that I think about a lot and try and work on too. And I think it's something I have room to grow in too. But I think often when you are putting new work out into the world, it needs to have a reason for it too. And I think that sometimes for me that reason can be musical, that it's like these are really interesting sounds that maybe we haven't heard before. But I think for me often it's a conceptual or social or I think there's a lot of other reasons that go beyond the notes on the page to bring new work into the world. And yeah, for me, those concepts that you were talking about are a big part of it. And I think also something that I've kind of found is that whenever I kind of clarify or become more specific with those concepts, I think it makes my music also more specific and more clear. It's one of those things where you can't just talk about the notes on the page. You also have to think about what it means. And that's something that's really important to me.
And I just want to tag on one other thought is that a lot of people are there, there's a genre of music called programmatic music that's storytelling. And of course, every story, every art, every piece of music is some kind of story trying to be shared. But I think what's so great about having the conceptual ideas first is that you're actually allowing performers, you're allowing audiences to have their own interpretations of what that is or looks like. Like, for instance, Asia had the image of Zelda and, refracting light with the prism idea, right? I didn't have that idea, right? And so I think to in some regard, like it's not, let's say, like Stravinsky's Firebird, where there's a very programmatic story that is being told through ballet. Of course, that maybe ballet is a different medium, I'm not sure, but regardless, it's something. It's an interesting take where a lot of other composers might have relied on a story, Strauss Alpine Symphony or whatever. This is actually a more inviting idea and concept for people who might not understand or think, oh, I don't understand new music. It's like, no, actually you might,
Absolutely. I think honestly, like in a lot of contemporary music, something that I think we sometimes pretend is that at least among composers, I think we often will sort of act like it's immediately accessible to everyone. And I think that for a lot of audiences, it just sort of isn't. And to give them something to latch on to, I think is really important. And I think that's true for concert music and music in general too. Like you want to give audiences something to connect to, something to latch on to. That's like really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason people like Beethoven 5 is because they've heard it a million times in various settings and they don't even know the whole thing, but they might be more willing to listen to the entire first movement or even the entire symphony just because they know like a little bit of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just having this personal connection to it and feeling that personal resonance too, which is like all what music is about. Yeah, connecting both to yourself and also to other people.
Thank you so much for your time today and sharing your music. I feel like I got to know you so well. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to learn more about you or your music?
So you can learn more about me on my website, which is paulnovakmusic.com. I'm also pretty active on social media. You can follow me on Instagram at PLNVK_. And I have a SoundCloud. I post some things other places on the internet too. But I just want to say it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much for inviting me on this podcast. I am also feeling tipsy at 3 p.m. and that's perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much again, and cheers.
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 Clink. Pour Me a Mozart is on Instagram and Facebook at Pour Me a Mozart. You can email us at pourmeamozart@gmail.com. Please rate on iTunes. I think you can rate and write reviews on Spotify.
I think so. Yeah.
If you're feeling extra generous, the Patreon is active again. It is surprise, surprise, at Pour Me a Mozart. Follow us all the places.
Yeah, and tell your friends and family.
Yes, please.
On the next episode of Pour Me a Mozart, we're joined by composer Nikki Son, who shares her music and experiences navigating the music world as a Korean female composer.
So whenever I write music, I have so many ideas and like things that I want to like put down. I love writing notes. That's like one of the best things about being a composer. So whenever I show my music to a performer or a composer, the thing that I hear the most is like, I think it would be great if we can hear this one more time. So I think like when we are working on a piece or like learning a piece, we're just like, oh, like we should maybe like vary that or change that. But as a listener's point of view, they need something to like stick with, right? They need something that they can reference to. So even though we are always reluctant to like play something exactly the same or write something that's repeating, I think it can help them to understand what you're trying to show them. I've had a lot of different teachers looking at my music, which has been very, very helpful. But I would say the most important mentor for me has been Gabriela Elena Frank. Yeah, so until I met her, I think all my teachers and mentors had been men. And until I met her, I really wasn't sure if I could really be a composer, because I just never saw anyone who looked like me doing it, you know? And so being a composer seemed like a very like vague, far away type of like vision that I had.